This is Jim Cotter. Welcome to our Creatively Speaking show archive. Our ability to present these programs online is supported by WRTI's listener members. If you're already a member, thanks so much. If you're not a member, why not, while you're listening, click on the Become a Member link on the left of all WRTI.org webpages. Your support is vital to ensure we can continue to produce this and all of the other programming you hear on WRTI. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello, on this week's program we walk through the Philadelphia Flower Show with designer Sam Lemony. Jason Pfeiffer examines the role of theatre critics and speaks with several exponents of the craft. We look ahead to the Kimmel Center's upcoming season. Susan Lewis considers why we both love and fear the Bard as the Philadelphia Shakespeare Festival opens its new season. And in our regular exploration of the Culture File section of GoPhila.com, we look ahead to Pennsylvania Ballet's revival of Franklin Court by speaking with architects Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown, the creators of the Center City Philadelphia structure that inspired the 1989 ballet. That's all ahead this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
With winter drawing to a close and the first day of spring just weeks away, this is the time of year when many people's thoughts turn to gardening. The Philadelphia Flower Show opens tomorrow, and the organizers hope that Enchanted Spring, a tribute to Mother Nature, will take visitors from the fantastical to the practical and inspire even the most hesitant of gardeners to take up a trowel and start planting. The centerpiece of the 10-acre show is Natura, Goddess of Nature, the largest plant sculpture in the world at 27 feet high and more than 60 feet long. We dropped in on preparations for the show earlier this week and took a walk with show designer Sam Lemony.
I think that's what the flower show is all about. It's about using your imagination and dreaming big. And the flower show is the largest flower show in the country, and it's the largest indoor flower show in the world. And why not do a 25-foot by 60-foot plant sculpture of Mother Nature? It's just a lot of fun. And the flower show is about having fun and using your imagination in your garden. And if you can dream it, you can build it.
You say that if we can dream it, we can build it. How much do sort of home gardeners, how much can they take away? They see an exhibition like this, an enormous horticultural sculpture. I'm sure this is going to inspire people, but presumably you're not going to be able to build something of this magnitude in your own garden.
Yeah, most of us aren't going to be able to build a 25-foot by 60-foot plant sculpture in their yard. But we hope to engage and to really inspire them to use their imagination and use the garden space that they have and have fun with it. It's okay to break some of the rules in design sometimes. It's your space. It's your garden. You pay great money for your house and your garden, so have fun with it and really kind of enjoy the space. And certainly we know the budget plays a role in that. We work within a budget, too, so it's certainly a way to just use your imagination and really have a great time.
We were just hearing some bird noises. We should actually emphasize that there are no actual birds inside the convention center. This is all just part of the sound system. Yeah?
Correct. Exactly. It's sound effects that we're including in them, because we will have birds and butterflies and other wildlife as part of the Floratopia tree, which is going to be the first thing you see when you walk into the show.
Going from model to actual finished work, do you ever surprise yourself when you look at it and you think, oh, wow, it's more than I thought, it's less than I thought? Are you ever surprised by the final outcome?
I think especially this year when we're doing something that's very much in from a very whimsical fantasy aspect that, I think we'll all be surprised when it's finished this year, because I think it's going to be something none of us have ever created before or even seen before. So this is something that we're really pulling together here at the Flower Show that we've been working on paper and models for the last couple of years. And to finally see it come to fruition and come to reality is really going to be a spectacular scene. And to see how big she is, it's really, we wanted her to be big, and she definitely is big.
Philadelphia Flower Show designer Sam Lemony. The show opens tomorrow and runs through March 12th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in Philadelphia.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Newspaper circulations have been falling in recent years, and because of this, many papers have been cutting costs and jobs. Just in the past few months, dozens of writers and editors from the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Daily News accepted buyouts as part of the paper's publisher's goal to reduce the newsroom staff by 16%. Among those who departed were two full-time theatre critics. While the Inquirer will continue to provide theatre coverage, it's apparent the newspaper will not completely fill the void left by the cutbacks. As theatre coverage and criticism in Philadelphia undergoes this transition, Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer decided to take a look at the job of the theatre critic and its role in the local theatre community. Here's his report.
The famous Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw once said, "The power of accurate observation is commonly called cynicism by those who have not got it." While Shaw's claim is debatable, he does make a point in suggesting that giving one's opinion, however accurate it might be, doesn't always go over well with others. Shaw would know. In addition to being a famous playwright, he was also a drama critic in his day.
I think critics are right up there with dentists in the popularity poll.
Toby Zinman is the new theater critic at the Philadelphia Inquirer. She takes over the theater beat after 14 years as a reviewer for Philadelphia's City Paper. Zinman, also a professor at the University of the Arts, comments that even though people in her profession might sometimes be called cynical, jaded, or even vicious, it's not a job she takes lightly.
It's such a brave thing to do what actors do, what playwrights do. You know, you just put it out there, and then I come in, you know, and in a couple of hours I go, pff. And that's really a responsibility. So you can't do that, I think, just blithely.
So what is it exactly that theater critics do? What function do they serve? For starters, Zinman describes a critic as a heightened audience member.
But I think we have to be knowledgeable. I mean, nobody would want me to write about a football game. I just couldn't bring anything to it. I could sit there and look at it, but I'm in the dark. So I think you have to have something to bring into the theater with you.
The need for a critic to have at least some theater background may seem like a no-brainer, yet it's not unheard of for a newspaper to send out, say, a sports reporter who was a good writer, to review a show, because the paper simply lacks a dedicated theater writer. J. Cooper Robb has been a theater critic at the Philadelphia Weekly since 2000. Like Toby Zinman, Robb believes it's essential that a critic knows the art form inside and out.
Theater critics are funny because you just kind of declare yourself one. Back when I started as working for student newspapers, it was just like, I'm a theater critic because I said I was a theater critic. And the reason people would listen and I suppose believe what I said was because it appeared in the newspaper. But I think to be a good theater critic, it's very, very helpful if you've worked in as many aspects of theater as possible. Most good theater critics have a background in theater in terms of working on productions and then also a background in the theory of theater and theater history.
Theater companies have long had a love-hate relationship with the critics. If something complimentary is written, they are quick to publicize the praise. If criticized, they're understandably quick to ignore or downplay the review. J. Cooper Robb admits that constructively criticizing a production was initially difficult for him, especially in a close-knit theater community like Philadelphia, where nearly everyone knows each other. Yet Robb says while he was raised by the philosophy, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all, a critic must operate differently.
It's not my job to promote the Philadelphia theater community, but one of my jobs is to support the Philadelphia theater community. And if by doing that, it's to say that this show is really awful and you should avoid it at all costs, then that's a way of supporting the Philadelphia theater community. You need to point out the bad with the good.
There are those who would argue that the bad is pointed out much more than the good by theater critics. But David Fox, a reviewer for the City Paper, counters that in his experience, most critics are eager to write positive reviews.
They may seem sometimes to be hypercritical of things that aren't as good, but I think you'll never find a more enthusiastic viewer than a critic who loves something. Because all the same things that make us go deeply into things that we feel negative about, I think we then apply to a positive experience.
Fox says while he's thrilled to have opportunities to bring good exposure to a company, he notes that's not his end goal.
I can't say often enough that the theater critic writes for a readership. I would think it's extremely pretentious to imagine that the directors of local theaters or the actors would learn something from me. That's not what I'm there for. If that's happened for somebody, it's great. I'm delighted, but that's not what I'm out to do, and I would never profess that that's what it's for.
Newspaper critics have they see their first obligation to the readership, but I think it's important that they also understand that they have an obligation to the forum.
That's Charles McMahon, artistic director of the Lantern Theater Company in Philadelphia. He goes on to explain that any analysis provided by a critic should respect all of the components that go into making theater happen. The director says that even if some aspects of a show do not work well, a good reviewer will thoughtfully analyze the other parts of the production as well, making distinction between elements like acting, directing, design, and the script. Even though all critics might not follow such guidelines, McMahon says he nevertheless pays attention to what they're saying.
You know, some people don't read them at all. I do read them. When the papers come out, I look at the review and I think, how is this going to affect us? Is there some way we can take advantage of what they've said to increase our sales, or is there some way that we can do some damage control if they didn't like it?
McMahon also says that although a review's impact is commonly unpredictable, at least for the Lantern Theatre, critic opinions do influence the ticket sales of a production. But not as much as they used to, says actor and Brat Productions artistic director Mady DiStefano.
When there was less going on in Philadelphia, a really knockout review and even the weekly would pack the house, and a good review in the Inquirer would certainly pack the house and maybe even sell out the run. But the Philadelphia theater scene and performance scene in general is growing more rapidly than the audience base is, and so even a good review doesn't necessarily make or break a production anymore.
Even though theater critics may not make or break a production, there remains a widespread sentiment that theater reviews still do carry some weight with readers. When done well, critics are also recognized for sparking healthy and thoughtful dialogue. In short, critics are valued members of the theater community. As theater in the region continues to grow in leaps and bounds, the question that remains is whether or not the quantity and quality of local theater criticism will also grow.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer. Questions, comments, criticisms? Email us, arts@wrti.org. This week, the Kimmel Center announced details of its 06-07 season. Visiting orchestras will include the New York Philharmonic, the NK Symphony on its first tour under music director Vladimir Ashkenazy, and the Gewandhaus Orchestra of Leipzig. The Master Musicians series will feature recitals by Joshua Bell, Leon Fleischer, and Sarah Chang, among others, while the center's new pipe organ will feature in more than 50 performances. The upcoming season will also showcase violinist Jennifer Coe as part of the fourth WRTI-sponsored Fresh Ink series of new music concerts, which will also include the Cronus Quartet and Eighth Blackbird. The WRTI-sponsored jazz concert series, which has previously honored John Coltrane, Dizzy Gillespie, and the country's great jazz cities, will next season focus on New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. Other jazz luminaries performing at the center will include McCoy Tyner, Ramsey Lewis, and Sonny Rollins. I spoke with Kimmel Center Vice President of Programming and Education, Mervon Mehta, following the season announcement earlier this week. After 5 years, does this get any easier?
You know what? It does not. Sometimes it gets harder because, you know what? When you start, you try anything. And now we know what works and sometimes, unfortunately, what doesn't in terms of sales and things like that, or what just doesn't fit the building. So your palate kind of shrinks a little bit. Now, there are always new artists coming up, but they have to be built up. And so I find it particularly on the classical side, it gets harder. On the jazz side, we could fill two seasons every year. On the classical side, to fill three recitalists, let's say, in our string series or piano series, of people that, first of all, we are of the quality we want, but can fill the number of seats in Philadelphia, very different than filling the seats in Chicago or New York or London. Philadelphia's a tough market. So we've tried some people that have been phenomenal but have not sold the tickets. So then you wonder, well, how often do we bring them back and lose money? So that's the tougher part on the classical side. But I'm thrilled that we're able to add recitals in the organ series. Unfortunately, we've had to let go of the vocal recital series. But they'll come back, maybe not as a series, but one or two at a time.
You're still taking risks. I mean, 36 debuts. Oh, yeah. Why? I mean, surely if you have this list, this now 5 years of artists that worked, do you still need to be putting yourself up for these kind of things?
Well, if we didn't, people like you would say, oh, same old every year. No, there's so many incredible artists out there, whether they're from Philadelphia or they're from Timbuktu, that need to be heard. And one of the things that I love is to introduce artists that maybe haven't been to the Kimmel Center before or haven't been to Philadelphia before and see if they can find a new market.
And just a final point, I mean, it is now after 5 years the case that the Kimmel Calling is a kind of a tried and tested product at this stage. You have a relationship with them. They trust your ability to present them correctly. Does that have any kind of a viral effect that artists talk to artists and say, you know, I had a good experience in Philadelphia, the Kimmel?
Absolutely. I mean, we see that especially on Danilo Perez's series. Danilo calls in the first year. He said, hey, I've got this new thing happening at the Kimmel. And they said, where? Philadelphia. What? Kimmel? I never heard of it. Now, when he calls up Wycliffe Gordon or he calls up Henry Butler and they say, oh, yeah, I heard about that thing you're doing in Philly at the Kimmel. That sounds cool. What date? Okay, I'll be there. And that's it. That's all we have to, we book that. Once we decide who we wanted, we finalize everything in 4 days.
Wow. The
first year, it took 3 months because we had to explain who we were, what the thing was, who Danilo, what we were trying to do, what kind of a ticket arrangement and what kind of fees were involved. Now that part is easier.
Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts Vice President of Programming and Education, Mervon Mehta. Broadway at the Academy, which is also programmed by the Kimmel Center, will present recent theater hits including Spamalot and Edward Scissorhands, and a revival of the 1970s hit Pippin. The Kimmel Center's 06-07 season begins on September 15th with a concert by Nancy Wilson. The Philadelphia Shakespeare Festival opens its ninth season on Wednesday. For the second year, the company will perform in repertory, rotating several plays over the course of 2.5 months. Almost 400 years after his death, Shakespeare is still ubiquitous on our cultural landscape. The Bard has inspired and continues to inspire songs, movies, plays, dance, and visual art. Yet his actual work, great theatre and literature, can sometimes be the least appreciated. Now, creatively speaking, Susan Lewis goes about trying to understand why today Shakespeare is, for some, love's labour's lost, and for others, much ado about nothing.
What is it about the Bard that makes us worship him and at the same time shake our heads and shrug? Who is this guy in a goatee and a lace collar who penned plays and poetry nearly 4 centuries ago, about whom people still obsess today? To say he's a literary giant is an understatement. He wrote 38 plays, 154 sonnets, 2 epic poems. He is said to be the most quoted literary figure in the history of the English language, responsible, some say, for inventing or popularizing 1 in every 10 English words. Walk into most bookstores, and you'll find that this son of a glovemaker from the English Midlands market town of Stratford-upon-Avon has not only his own shelf, but his own section with his complete works in multiple editions, as well as generations of secondary works analyzing, clarifying, and interpreting him, everything from scholarly studies to Shakespeare for Dummies. And yet, at the same time, let's face it, many of us think of him as literary Brussels sprouts. Good for you, but not so sweet. Yes, we slogged through 10th grade English, saw a high school production, maybe even took in a movie or two. But how often have we experienced him, theatrically speaking, since? And Shakespeare's probably not the book you toss into your bag for vacation. Although if you knew you'd be stranded on a desert island, you might dust off his complete works. All the world's a stage, the great man wrote. Maybe some people get his plays and some people don't. But I'd guess there are more than a few of us who stand in the wings, waiting for the right cue to enter Shakespeare's world. Carmen Kahn, the founder and artistic director of the Philadelphia Shakespeare Festival, didn't wait long. She was turned on to Shakespeare at an early age in her native London in a way, she says, that changed the direction of her life.
I was about 14 when I first discovered Shakespeare, and it was a teacher, an English teacher. It was a new school, and she started quoting a passage from Macbeth, and I was totally blown away. And where I grew up was really rough, and there were these groups of boys, and they would just go around the streets, and if my brother and I'd be playing, you just had to run for it because they'd just beat you up. So as soon as I discovered art, I escaped. Life wasn't just survival anymore. There was the possibility of it being a creative, engaging journey. So that was sort of the door opening.
If Shakespeare can have such power over a teenage girl, what's stopping the rest of us from getting him? Bad memories from high school? Fear of deciphering 400-year-old words? Is he just too daunting? If you are at all daunted by Shakespeare, you're in good company. Mark Rylance was artistic director of London's Globe Theatre for 10 years and played the lead in their recent touring production of Measure for Measure, which ran at Penn's Zellerbach Theatre late last year. And he admits that even he can feel intimidated by Shakespeare.
People can be so clever about it, and there's so many books written about it, but you've got to remember it was written like a TV comedy. There are wonderful ideas in it, but understanding Shakespeare is not as important as enjoying it. He intended his plays to be played and be funny and be enjoyable, and if you got something out of it, great, and if you just had a good time, I think he would have been very, very happy with that.
Getting people to enjoy Shakespeare, to think of his work as, well, fun, is a challenge to which the Philadelphia Shakespeare Festival has at least 2 solutions. One is to catch kids when they first study Shakespeare, before they decide that it's too difficult or boring. To do this, the company combines its performance mission with educational programs in the schools. The other solution is to do what every Shakespeare production must attempt, to tap into the urgency of the human experience within the drama, which is not always easy or obvious, since Shakespeare wrote plays for performances that he himself would direct when he could fill in a lot of the details. The Philadelphia Shakespeare Festival finds this deeper layer of meaning through what it calls reverse engineering, as Kahn explains.
You have to go back and figure out every scene that he did, every scene that he wrote. You have to figure out what the drama is. I mean, it seems simplistic, but if that's not in the actor's mind, it just becomes a reading.
This week, the festival's ninth season opens, its second year of performing in repertory. Between March and May, three plays will run concurrently: The Tempest, Much Ado About Nothing, and for a light introduction to Shakespeare, the complete works of William Shakespeare, abridged. And seeing it, hearing it, getting into that theater and experiencing it is what Shakespeare was 400 years ago and is now all about, say both Carmen Kahn and Mark Rylance.
It wasn't written to be read, it was written to be heard. So reading it is a little bit like reading a Bruce Springsteen song. It won't make any sense at all, actually. But when you hear it sung, then it makes sense because you understand more the emotion of it.
His emotional literacy, it was so great. And if it's done well, we have this recognition about ourselves. We found that mostly when people come out, is this emotional experience that they've had, and with a lot of great beauty and poetry along with it, you know.
Philadelphia Shakespeare Festival Artistic Director Carmen Kahn ending that report by creatively speaking Susan Lewis. The festival's new season begins on Wednesday with the complete works of Shakespeare abridged. The Philadelphia Shakespeare Festival Theatre is at 2111 Sampson Street. Now it's time for our regular dip into the culture file section of gophilla.com. In 1976, as part of the bicentenary celebrations, the National Park Service commissioned world-renowned architects Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown to design a museum on the site of Benjamin Franklin's Philadelphia residence just off Market Street. Instead of trying to recreate Franklin's house, the architects decided on a less conventional approach. They created a ghost house, a metal carcass that outlined the shape and dimensions of Franklin's home, with portals through which could be seen the Franklin's privy pits, wells, and the foundations of the house. Franklin Court was in turn the inspiration for a ballet created by Christopher D'Amboise for Pennsylvania Ballet in 1989. It's now being revived by the company. In this, the 30th anniversary of the structure, I met recently at Franklin Court with its creators, the architects Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown.
As we worked on it, we thought that putting a building on the site wasn't a very good idea and wasn't necessary. First of all, the excavation had been done of the building itself, and we knew that there was no way of reproducing that building. And the only remains that there were of the plan and actually kitchen middens in the basement, which are underwhelming. So it didn't seem as if putting back that much would be a very good idea. Then we had the idea that urbanistically this site could be something for the neighborhood, something open where people could come and eat their lunch. And to my great joy, sitting here one day, I saw someone just walking across with his briefcase. He used it as a shortcut. And that's wonderful when things like that happen as well. And so using it as an urban site and putting the museum underground seemed to make a good deal of sense, particularly because the museum was, in fact, to have no windows. So it all went together very well. We had to allow for large crowds, and this could certainly do that. Then, as for the ghost that you see here, I think Bob should describe how that happened.
Sure. So, Bob, firstly, when you unveiled your plans for this ghost structure, what was the reaction?
Surprisingly, it was well received. The client, who was the National Park Service, were agreeable. And the ghost structure evolves out of the excavations that had been made concerning the house. So we all knew the plan of the house, the extent of the house, as a result of analyzing the foundations. And at the same time, you could look down through these little look through elements and see the actual excavations and some aspects of that. But the ghost structure we loved very much from the beginning, and it's an idea we got very early in our thinking, saying, oh, we do need some kind of iconic element here that you take away with you that identifies this place as the site of Benjamin Franklin's house sitting within the block. And so we hope this has worked, and we think it has, as a kind of sculptural element that identifies this place and signifies this place and is, as I said, an icon within the this part of the city.
There was no pictorial record of what actually stood here beforehand.
It's very significant that there was no record, and that's why the house could not be reconstructed. We worked with wonderful scholars at the time and historians, and there was some description of the house. There were some indications that derived from insurance contracts that he had concerning the house. But this evolves out of some verbal information we have and from the archaeological elements below grade. And it's an irony that there remains evidently no illustration of Benjamin Franklin's house.
But a very important written record was the letter writing between Franklin and France and his wife here. And so if you see photographs of this building and people are looking down at the floor, it's because we've taken excerpts from those letters and put them where they belonged to give you a word picture at any rate. It says over here, in the front room which I have designed for guests, I have the bed which you sent from England, a chamber mahogany table and stand. And that's Deborah Franklin to Ben Franklin, fall 1765. Lots like that. And this was the first time we had the idea of putting writing in a landscape. That's a theme that we've used now many other places. For example, in the Welcome Park, where it celebrates William Penn, and also in Washington for Western Plaza.
You spoke earlier about the fact that the first time you sat here and you saw somebody walk through with a briefcase who was using it as a shortcut. Do either of you now return here at any time and see how it's being used by people today, 30 years later?
Alas, we do not, because we are such workaholics. We just work. We have to travel a lot. We've just returned from 3 weeks in China. So we work 7 days a week. We are in the office, and we really don't do pleasant things like this.
So this is a nice break for you.
This is, and we don't see many of our friends. We have this motto, we're too busy to be nice, which is awful.
But we do go and look at the buildings and see how they're working and analyze that.
Did you see the original ballet, or have you any aspirations to see the new one?
We did.
Is this an opportunity for you to be less busy enough to be nice?
No, we would be nice. We definitely must go there and see it. Another thing is, I'm standing here, I'm reminded by and liking very much all of the variety beyond this space.
Yes.
And that's part of the Philadelphia scene, where you have the rigidity and the consistency of the gridiron plan established by William Penn. But then within that plan, all sorts of things could happen. There's no hierarchy. It could evolve over time, and it could be, again, American-ly and Philadelphian-like, and especially Franklin-like, full of contradictions and tensions and variety.
Architects Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown, creators of Franklin Court. More information on Franklin Court can be found at the Culture File section of gophila.com. While Pennsylvania Ballet's revival of Christopher D'Amboise's work, Franklin Court, is at the Academy of Music through next Saturday. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Karen Lyman, Stephanie Grant, Susan Scanlon, Steve Moore, and Paula Butler. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.